The truth is that everything we've been discussing up till now is really the preamble, and now we really start. This is the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, right? We could have, and maybe should have, spent a little more time on the actual avdus, on the actual bondage in Mitzrayim, but we have to move on to the real big things, which is now. So we're going to begin by giving a little bit more preamble. We're actually starting the subject of Yetzias Mitzrayim tonight. And we're going to preface it just to put it into the right setting before we actually start. So first of all, what are the dynamics here? Let's again sum up for ourselves what's going on here. In Mitzrayim is when Hashem courted the Jewish people. That's what's really going on here. There is a Jewish people who are in the depths of despair. They've been abused for a long time, 2 centuries. They basically reached the situation of a slave race. Mitzrayim worked with a big caste system. They were all the way at the bottom. It's a huge empire, the greatest empire in the world, most powerful, most developed from every respect. And there were all kinds of levels. There were a lot of castes, right? And all the way at the bottom was the Jewish people, a foreign, despised, subhuman, as we'll see soon. That was part of what the Mitzrayim subjected them to dehumanize them. Race. Who, not only in the Mitzrayim's eyes, were they already a built-in part of the system. It was the boiler room. It was the machinery room of the Egyptian nation. But also in the Jews' eyes, in general. They knew that, yes, they were the bottom underdogs of the Egyptian nation, and that was that. There was tradition, and there was a core of cries hold on to the tradition, but that was basically that. And what's going on is that the truth is that these people who are abandoned, orphaned, seemingly with no one to care for them, actually do have a very great and powerful father who's watching what's going on and is growing angrier and angrier. Now here we have to put the dynamics into perspective, because we kept stressing the whole time how Hashem set this all up. So where is there room for wrath? But the story of the Makos is Hashem coming in and Kiviyachol going nuts over what he sees going on to his children and tearing apart the offenders. But if this was all Hashem's plan, where is there room for wrath? So here, of course, we draw on the Ramban. I'm going to put it into perspective with a mashal that the Ben Ishchai uses. A very humorous perspective, and this will really bring us up to our subject. It says, this is really the story here. Moshe comes to Paroi, 2 old men come limping into Paroi, and they say, Hashem Elokeinu Ivrim. One of them stutters, can barely talk. And the other one, his older brother, is his representative. Hashem Elokeinu Ivrim Shlochani Aleichem. Hashem, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you. And Paroi says, Mi Hashem? Who is Hashem? So the Ben Ishchai gives a mashal. He says, there were once two friends. Two friends made a deal. They used to buy lottery tickets. And they made up that let's double our chances. Let's make up that if either of us wins, we split the prize with the other. So it doubles our chances. We're going to have the prize, but it's worth it. That's what they made up. They made it up in a handshake. No writing. But that's what they made up. Either of us wins, we split the prize. Oh, one morning, A wakes up and is banging on the door, frantic banging on the door. Opens the door, there's B. And B says, did you hear? A says, no. B says, your number came up. Your number one. And A says, really? I don't believe it. Wow. He's all excited. And B says, you remember our agreement? A says, what? I'm supposed to take the kids today? So, well, we made up that we're going to split the prize, right? we made up that I'm going to split the prize? I don't remember. Oh, we did discuss something. I don't think I would have said that we would split the prize. I'll give you something, but to split the... No, we made up that we're going to split the prize. You don't remember? No, I'm pretty certain I didn't say that. I probably said I'll give you something. I will give you something. Oh, $500. So the beast says, you don't remember what we made up? He says, no, it is coming back to me. I told you I'd give you something. He says, are you sure that's what we agreed? He says, yeah. He says, oh, okay, that's good. I just wanted to clarify because really my number came up. I wanted to see exactly where we were standing. Okay. So, Hashem comes to Paroi. Paroi could say, look, Hashem, this was your plan, right? You told Avraham Avinu, Rispen Absarim, Vavadim Ve'inu Oysam, who, like Paroi, is a loyal servant of Hashem who wants to make sure that Ve'inu Oysam is done in the best way possible. I did Ve'inu Oysam Behidur. I made sure that they suffered. Wanted to make sure that your will would be carried out. You want them back? By all means. So Hashem said, you know what? Here's how we'll test it. Moshe comes to Paroi and says, Paroi's going to claim, as soon as the punishments start coming, Paroi's going to claim, this was your will, what do you want from me? So it's my will? So, Moshe comes to Paroi and says, you know what Hashem said to let them go? If Paroi says, oh, okay, this is all just about Hashem, says to let them go, I'll let them go. Well, what does Paroi answer? Paroi said, me Hashem. Who's Hashem? Hashem says, oh, very good. Alright, now enjoy the 10 markers. Now enjoy what's coming. So,
Paro really had knowledge of Hashem?
What's that?
Paro had knowledge of Hashem?
That is questionable.
And he knew the relationship? Okay.
That's not so clear. He had some knowledge of Hashem. He had some knowledge of Hashem. The people knew about Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu was a famous personality. They knew that Avraham Avinu was led by a god. He's coming and saying, this is the god of Avraham Avinu. He knew of such a thing. When he said, me Hashem, what he meant was, who is he, as in, who are you? Right? Meaning, Avraham Avinu had a god. He's the god of this nation. But, what does that mean to me? I have stronger gods. What's that?
I don't get the connection.
No, so the thing is that Hashem was bringing out, and this is what really the Ramban spells this out in a more serious way. I give the Ben Yishai's mashal. But the Ramban spells it out in a more serious way. And says that, well, I'm putting the Rambam and the Ramban together. He says that Paroi was not acting as a pious implementer of Hashem's plan, and also more than that. The Ramban says that itself, he still wanted to be blamed. If at the end of the day he was doing what Hashem wanted, okay. But Paroi went much further. Paroi went on a sadistic campaign motivated by hatred through his own Bechira to really torment the Jewish people and to bring them to the lowest state he possibly can to try to get rid of them. That was his campaign, and he went further than Hashem had in mind. And therefore, he truly angered Hashem. And the whole thing could have played out differently. It did not have to play out this way. And now, Hashem is getting ready to take action. So, okay. That's an interesting... I'm going to leave that for now. But that's a chash of a point. The Torah Zevira dwells on that. But I'll leave that for now. Okay, so what's going on? So Hashem comes and makes his approach to Paroi. Paroi says, "Me Hashem, you know who I am? Me Hashem." And the whole continuation of the story is really just Hashem's answer to that question. "Me Hashem? Oh, I'll show you. Sit down, and we're going to start." So in other words, what was Paroi saying? We mentioned this a few times. Paroi was saying they might have a god. We all have our gods. Gods abound. Some gods are stronger, some gods are weaker. The Egyptian nation has the strongest gods in the world. The Egyptian nation has the top sorcerers in the world. We're at the top of the whole spiritual system too. They had a Nile, They had the sheep, whatever that represented in their upper spheres. They had all kinds of things that they worshipped. Very chash of a team of gods, compounded by a very chash of a team of sorcerers. And Pari's not scared. He knows that his gods are stronger than the gods of the other nations around. Much more successful than the Canaanite gods and all of those. So, maybe the Hebrews have a god. He doesn't have a very impressive track record. What's he been doing for his people up till now? I'm ready to take him on too. That was Pari's challenge. And Hashem is accepting the challenge. And here we start the story. So actually what's going on is we're heading for a showdown. As they say, I think the expression is a clash of the titans. Is that the expression? A clash of the titans. The mightiest, up till now, the mightiest force in the world is Pari. In control of the greatest gods and team of sorcerers in the world, is ready to take on whoever this god of the Hebrews thinks he is. Okay? So Pari is sitting confidently on his throne, has no idea. Have to remember that with all the gods they believed in, they did not have the concept of a almighty. We've been talking about what gods are. Like, each one has his properties and has his powers and some, and in a big way it's an issue of knowing how to manipulate them. But the concept of an almighty, all-powerful God who's absolutely in control, in that sense they were atheists. The whole world is atheists. Nobody believed in that. So Pari has no idea who he just challenged. But he's sitting on his throne confidently and he doesn't realize that the ground beneath him is starting to burn. All of nature is churning. Hashem is approaching. The Almighty is approaching. Pari is sitting. He's ready to take him on. And here's where the story starts. So let's picture this. You have the mightiest nation in the world. Take the United States. We'll use them as our example. And two weird, how do you say Timhoni in English? Two eccentric old men are standing outside the White House picketing. Right? They're demanding improved conditions for a certain tribe of Indians somewhere in Arkansas, and they're saying that the whole United States will suffer otherwise. There's a small write-up in the news about this funny phenomenon taking place outside of the White House. And they're not getting much attention. Finally, when the president does come out for his walk or something, they yell out to him and he says, okay, do what you want to do. And they say, okay. So they go hobbling over to the Pentagon. They look at it. Boom, the Pentagon collapses. Alright, now let's get on to our story. I'm just trying to put things into perspective. Now let's get on to our story. Hashem gives the warning. Here's this Gadala of the Hebrews who's about to try to prove himself against the great mighty Pari. Okay. We start with Makas Dam. And now here, just give one more little parenthetical point. We're going to very much be drawing on Chazal's Medrash of Mida Keneged Mida. Now let's understand that this is not an example of Chazal's Kabbalah. This is an example. The Mida Keneged Mida that Chazal came up with in the Makas was really, what I'm trying to convey is that this is how we're supposed to approach the Makas. To sit and study the dynamics of the Makas from every possible angle. That's what Chazal did. Try to study the dynamics. What was Hashem showing? Where's the irony? What messages was Hashem conveying? What did all the different people present feel at the time? Try to really get into the reality and experience it. People were picking up on all kinds of different angles and dynamics and messages that were coming through the Makas. Because Hashem was actually teaching everybody who He is. Makas Dam. We start with the Nile. Who's the Nile? The Nile we talked about. Egypt. With all of its mighty gods, the Nile is one of the superstars on the list. Pari says in Yeshaya, Liya Oyri Vani Asisini. When Pari declares himself God, what's his expression? I've got my Nile and I made myself. Either that's the pshat in the pasuk or it isn't. Different mafarshim, whatever it is. Pari was full of himself. Okay? Now, how is he expressing his greatness? Because he's on the same team as the Nile. Nile is one of the greatest forces of nature. One of the mightiest forces in the world. The Nile was what made Egypt what it was. Egypt was a completely independent country, never had to worry about anything. They had their years of famine. That was a very, very unnatural phenomenon. Because normally the Nile completely provided them with everything they need. When the Nile was there, the Egyptians were safe. So, basically, here's this God of the Hebrews coming, and in round one, boom! That great, mighty Nile, the great God, is bloodied, defeated on its feet. This is more than the Pentagon collapsing. Right? So that's round one. This anonymous God of the Hebrews. Mi Hashem. That's what Hashem was. The big star is already knocked out. Knocked out of the fight. Now let's know what's going on here. The Nile, the mighty God, is brought down to its knees in such an ignominious way. It stinks. It turns into a source of pollution for the entire land of Mitzrayim. The entire land of Mitzrayim now stinks. It was disgrace, not just that the Egyptians were suffering, but note what's going on. One of the things that the whole world respected them to is knocked flat. Knocked flat and in complete disgrace. It's giving off terrible odors. It's just vomiting dead fish. And it's causing a stench that's permeating the entire land. Now let's understand what's going on. Again, we all heard in kindergarten that all the water turned to blood. They had to drink orange juice for that week. Let's understand what the significance of the fact was. Try to approach it from a mature perspective. What it means. Okay? And first of all, that very disillusionment. That was such a blow to Egyptian pride. Number one, off the cuff, before we even got in, the bell just rang. And the Nile is already out of the fight. Okay? But now, let's appreciate what it means that all the water in Mitzrayim turned into blood. All the water in Mitzrayim means. Obviously, there was no drinking water. Oh boy. Oh boy. You're noting the riches of the Chatumim. You know where the Chatumim had to get their water from? Well, there are two pshatim. Okay? What? Two pshatim. Either it was water that they bought from the Jews. You hear what they did? Where'd they get water from? They had to buy it from the Jews. They bought Jews from the water. They had to stoop, right? Lower their dignity to go and pay the exorbitant price of the Jews. Bring back that water and do their fakery with it. Okay? Others say that water that was underground wasn't affected by the Makkah. And therefore, if they bought water up from springs on the ground, it was okay. Okay. In fact, some take this a step further and say that it was really just a fake. They bought the water up, and people saw as they did it with sleight of hand in a way that people got the impression they actually had water up in their hands, and they were bringing water up from the depths, and then it turned into blood because it became vulnerable to the Makkah of Dam. Okay, that's already academics. We'll leave that for now. But that's number one. Now number two, let's understand the effect that it actually had. What was the Makkah of Dam? So of course there's no drinking water. It's obvious. There's no drinking water. But not only that, they drank a little water in the morning. They had this stuff in their mouth. What they washed their mouths out with? There's nothing to wash your mouth out of. Okay? Obviously. When they first started drinking, if they didn't chop, or if they did chop, whatever it is, there's nothing to wash your mouth out with. Meaning, if you by mistake did get a little bit of into your mouth, you're now tormented for the rest of the week. Well, the rest of the day. But then again, if you're not drinking, okay? And now, it's also more than that. Because sweat turned into blood, spittle turned into blood. They were stuck in sticky blood, right? With sticky blood all over their bodies. Their clothing were soiled. There's obviously no water to wash anything with, right? The moisture in the air turned into blood. All water. All water means there's a lot of water in the air. Is that they were walking through a thick, disgusting fog of nauseous substance. Can you imagine this, walking and breathing blood, and you can't get a fresh glass of water? You could. It costed a lot of money, though. It cost a lot of money. They spent a lot of money. You had to buy it from the Jewish people, but they were willing to pay the price. Can you imagine not being able to relieve yourself? You did. You had to. But you rationed it. Every cup of water costed who knows what, and you needed it desperately.
Is that a midrash?
What's that?
If I was drinking water, they were in the same place. They were drinking blood.
If they didn't pay, if they paid Jews, if they purchased water from Jews, it stayed water and they could drink it. This must be so because, think about it, there wouldn't have been any surviving Egyptians at the end of the week. You have to realize this too. Let's realize it's not like, oh, they went through a rough week and then life got back on track. People died. Right? You're going a week without water. It left Mitzrayim with dead all over the place. The survivors were the people who were shelling out money like nobody's business and managed to do it on time. So they were left close to broke. Okay, maybe they were rich. I don't know exactly how much the Jews charged. Maybe the Jews were nice about it. I don't know. But let's understand that naturally, the Egyptian people were doomed with Makas Dam. It was a Makas you couldn't survive. Imagine breathing that type of stuff for a half a day and not being able to drink water. Normally, a person will die after a couple of days. Forget about a week of not drinking, not having any water available. And when you're not exposed to the stench, realize what the Nile was doing to all the air in Mitzrayim, besides the fact that the moisture in the air was blood. But all the dead fish was doing. The pollution was terrible. The place was unbreathable. This is what they were living with for a week. We don't appreciate it.
And they sure wanted to go for a swim.
Factor that into the Egyptian experience. They're watching the Jewish people enjoying the sight and drinking plenty of water. Now, here Chazal come with the Mida Keneged Mida, and there are messages being conveyed here. It's not just this. This is enough, I think. We can move on to Makas Tzvadei already. But no, we're not finished. There was a big message here. For years, the Egyptians had been tossing Jewish children into the Nile. And basically the feeling was, they're the masters. These are their property, without any rights. Nobody's there to stand up for them. Nobody's there to demand that blood, to make an accounting, right? To come and exact a cheshbon from them. Who's watching? All of a sudden, the Nile turns into blood. These people, let's remember, they were a superstitious bunch. They took these things as omens. All of a sudden, all of that blood is being thrown in their face. The Nile turns into blood. All the blood that they thought was well sunk under the Nile is being brought up, it's surfacing. This was haunting. It was scary. It was very ominous. It was threatening. Like there's someone who's saying, you thought no one was watching? There was someone very big watching the whole time. I noted all that blood. See all that blood? That blood didn't go unnoticed. That blood was very noticed. This is what Chazal say. The Mida Keneged Mida. And part of the bondage was, Chazal tell us, that when a Jew, let's understand the misery of the Jewish people in Mitzrayim, could not fill his daily quota of bricks, what did the Mitzrayim do? They took his baby and they built it into the wall to fill some of the space that he couldn't fill. Many of the walls of the structures in Egypt contained Jewish corpses. And now the walls were bleeding. The moisture of the walls. Wood contains moisture. All of this came seeping out. This was now blood. Walls looked bloody. The Egyptians got the message. They were being shown the blood of the Jewish babies who are inside those walls. This was being thrown at them in all directions, from all angles. They couldn't get away from it. So it wasn't just the hell of the actual experience, which was enough, right? But it was the guilt that was being thrown at them the whole time, that they just couldn't get away from it. It was that too, that's right. These are some things to think about. The truth is that everything that I've just described now is really just an attempt to describe from a mature perspective, right? What the experience was like. Now we have to each take it further and sit and contemplate. What was it like for all the liquid in the land to have been blood at that time? This is just a sampling. Well, we're supposed to sit up all night on Pesach night and continue contemplating this and getting more insight. What's that? They were being shaken to the core. Absolutely. What's that? Well, we'll say this. Exactly what each Egyptian Cheshvan HaNefesh was, we don't know. What we do know was that by the time the Makkas ended, even before Makkas Bechiris, the Egyptians were in a state of almost worshipping the Jewish people. Right? It says that the Jewish people were very, very esteemed in their eyes. And that, therefore, they were also piling up all kinds of gifts on them. They felt like they were appeasing the great forces that they had messed with. That's the Erev Rav. Is that too? That's right. Who are the Erev Rav? We know the Erev Rav is a bunch of troublemakers. But let's realize that these troublemakers didn't drop everything they had in Egypt and come out to the Midbar for nothing. Who were they? They were people who were impressed by everything they saw and they wanted to join the Jewish people. It wasn't good for the Jewish people. But these were conscientious Egyptians. That's who they were. Okay. After a week, Hashem lets up. Where does this leave Mitzrayim? Mitzrayim is in shambles. Now again, it wasn't like, okay, sponge out and back to life. Mitzrayim is in shambles. First of all, think about the atmospheric changes that it caused. The Nile, the air, the pollution. Who knows how long? Hashem didn't change all those things when the Makkah ended. This was something they stayed suffering with for a while. Now, Barbanel actually says that the Makkas, once this process was set in place, the Makkas were almost natural results of each other. And the Malbim really doesn't like that. He says there was nothing natural here going on. But in that sense, right, it's just to appreciate the effect of what this was. It wasn't like a cartoon where now it's blood and now it's not. The effect remained. And there's no question that thousands of people had died. Egypt was a mess. They didn't know when it would end. That was part of the torture. Maybe after a couple of Makkas they figured out the pattern. What? In the other Makkas, right. Okay, now on top of that, first of all, let's remember the Egyptians didn't eat most cattle meat. The fish was a big industry in Mitzrayim. There's no fish anymore. Fish is off the diet. But for a long time. Had to start breeding them in pools again, but it's going to take a long time before the fish industry gets back in its feet. So that's number one. Makkas Dam ended, the fish industry was finished. Right? I don't know how long it took to get it back in process. Clothes are ruined, homes are ruined, right? And the disillusionment of the Nile. The Nile was such an icon. And now they saw the Nile completely brought to its knees and disgraced by this God of the Hebrews. So they're already starting to get a picture that the God of the Hebrews is someone to reckon with. Right? Now, Hashem is playing games with Paro. Okay? So Hashem comes back to Paro and sits down at the negotiating table again. Paro is still a mandoma. Right? Okay. Now will you let my people go? Oh, I'm being asked. Okay? Paro tries to regain his dignity, brushes his teeth well at the Makkas Dam, and he sits back down at the table. He's ready to negotiate again. Well, he's got his heirs back. Oh no, he's not letting anybody go. Okay. So let's see what's this God of the Hebrews going to do now. Now, Makkas Sfardeya. So let's note also, this is already the next stage. That big great Nile has completely let them down, now turns into the source of their problems. All of a sudden the Nile shoots at them, hordes of frogs. Right? What's going on here? Hashem is showing more than that. Not only doesn't your Nile hold a candle against me, but actually, turns out, that the Nile is simply a humble servant of mine. I tell the Nile, Sikkim, and that great god of yours suddenly turns against you, and he's all over you like a ton of bricks or a ton of frogs. This is what was going on. The Egyptians are mamish getting it thrown in their face. The Nile is a meek little servant of Hashem, that big great Nile. You know, this little god of the Hebrews came, and all of a sudden the Nile is rushing like a puppy to do whatever he says and turning against its loyal subjects, the Mitzrayim. So yes, the hordes of frogs come streaming out of the Nile. So let's start picturing exactly what's going on here also. So what sizes were these frogs? Okay, we have the measures that it was one huge frog, but let's say that it was basically the range of sizes of the frogs we know now, which ranges from about 2 centimeters to about 30. That's basically the range of frogs at now. The land was completely full of them. Okay? So, what happens? Paro is sitting on his throne with his advisors, laughing at these two old men. And all of a sudden, a horde of frogs come streaming into the throne room. And Chashev HaParo is in the middle of speaking. And suddenly, actually, you know what Chazal say? Without Chazal, we can just say, but what Chazal say was that HaParo was in the middle of speaking. Now, this is a distinguished sight. The frogs came up from the bottom. And as he's in the middle of speaking, frogs jumped out of his mouth. Picture the sight. All the ministers are sitting. Now, HaParo, he was also a god. He put himself on the list too. They had a whole list. He made sure he was prominent on the roster list. Anybody who stood before HaParo stood in an absolute statue state of... Even his close ministers had to measure every word they said. And they speak each word with permission. HaParo was... He stood in a state of worship and reverence. The ministers are standing there. And as HaParo is trying to speak, a big frog comes shooting out of his mouth. I would imagine it took an awful lot for them to maintain a straight face. But they had to, somehow or the other. Right? But it wasn't so funny, because after a while, they're feeling it too. This is what was going on. Now, let's start picturing life with Makas Tzfadeh. So again, we say, yeah, it was a bunch of frogs, and they jumped in the food, and that was that. They were all over the place, which meant that when you stepped down, you slipped. You felt the mushy feeling, and you slid. It was better than a banana peel. Frogs are better than banana peels. Right? Skates. Better than any skates you'd ever use. People couldn't stand. I finally found a place to stand, but the area was swarming. You lie down on bed and you felt movement on your back. It was disgusting. Right? Now, you open your mouth, a frog jumps in. They were all over the place. Has anybody here ever experienced, I'm sure you've experienced this, when you're in bed, you're not sure exactly what time it is, but you're up because you're hearing, you hear a mosquito, and you can't fall asleep, and it's you hear it right around your ear, and you're slapping, and this and that. You know, it's about somewhere between 2 and 3 in the morning. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Yeah? Okay? It's a mosquito. You go nuts for an hour, right? And you're slapping, and this, it's still right by your ear. And you're sure you got it. It's still there. You're still hearing that buzz. Right? You go nuts. Imagine a person is lying in bed, and all of a sudden in his ear, okay, there's a little one, a 2-centimeter guy. He goes, slaps it out, boom, all of a sudden he gets a punch in the stomach, it's a 30-centimeter guy. I'm just talking about the ranges of frogs that we have today. 2 meters to 30, okay? You can't fall asleep, you don't know when the next one is going to fall. And they do fall, right? You suddenly start drifting off, you feel wiggling in your nose. This is what was going on. Now this is funny, but this is a hellish experience. People, didn't wake up the next morning, they were up the whole night. And this went on for another day. And for another day. And all the kids were also up. Just picture that. And it is a fourth day. People were completely going out of their minds. They were going out of their minds. That's what it was. That's right. Yeah. And now, once again, this is all sent by who? Their great Nile. The great Nile that he had brought Karbanis to the other week. Now, here too, Hashem is sending messages. I've been here the whole time. all the things that you thought went unnoticed, sending messages to the Jews and the Egyptians. I was noting every last detail. Every last detail. For example, the Egyptians made a practice of this. What I just described about going to sleep, besides this all, forget all the feelings and all that, the noise. It's a roar. It was deafening. That was a ruckus. The Egyptians had made it a practice of doing this to the Jewish people. Part of their whole program of tormenting the Jewish people was noises that kept them up at night. No one could miss the parallel of the Egyptians who had tormented the Jewish people in this way. When they finally went home to sleep after a day of backbreaking labor, the Egyptians would come and make loud commotions outside where they were sleeping to drive the Jewish people nuts, and they did it effectively. They did it effectively. No one could miss the parallel that now the Egyptians are tossing and turning in their beds in a much more exciting way than the Jews did. No one could miss the parallel. Hashem is showing, I noted everything, every dynamic. The subtlest feelings I noted too. Another thing that was noted, the Egyptians, when they would carry off the Jewish children, you can imagine that mothers don't take that sitting down. What are you going to do against a unit of big, burly Egyptian soldiers? Standard practice was, you have to think about this in realistic terms because it's heartbreaking. We have babies. Think about it in those terms. They would pile the babies into a wagon and head off, and there would be a whole procession of Jewish mothers walking behind, wailing loudly. This was the scene. You have to picture that, not about abstract babies from a few thousand years ago, but of a baby that you know, tossed into the wagon. Try to picture that. And the burly Egyptian soldiers are laughing and mocking and imitating the wails of these women. This was standard procedure, a standard sight of the parade arriving at the Nile with the new wagon load of babies to chuck in. And all of a sudden, from the Nile is emerging these wailing sounds. Wailing sounds that in their minds very much resembled the wailing sounds of the women. And of their mockery of the women, all of a sudden, is coming now from the Nile in deafening tones. They couldn't miss this. Couldn't miss this. It was haunting them. Coming back to haunt them. Everything was noted. There's a major, very, very great force out there now throwing it all back at you. Showing you, I noted it. And beware, because you're in trouble. It was noted. And another part of the irony was, now, okay, if we had gone through... It's okay, the Egyptian adults ended up thrown into the sea. We'll get there too. But there's a lot of me that connected me that we have to go through until we get there. That's the end. Right? We don't want to finish them off so fast. Why not? Hashem wants it to be a full show from beginning to end, not a quick show. Okay, now another point was, and again, if we would have gone through the Shibud a little more in detail, we would actually address these things. We're going to see these different elements in the context of the Makkos. But another part of it was, the Mitzrayim, as we'll see soon also regarding the other Makkos, part of what they were doing was imposing on the Jews unnecessary jobs just for the fun of it, just to see them work. They used to make the Jews catch all kinds of insects and things just to bring back to them. Frogs. So they would always be demanding of the Jews, oh, we need this, we need that. All of a sudden, Hashem says, you know what? I'm the God of the Jews. You wanted all kinds of creatures? Here! Boom! And the land swarmed with frogs. They got what they wanted. They got what they wanted. All these things were being thrown in the Egyptians' faces. But more importantly, the Jews were seeing this. The Jews were all of a sudden seeing that there was someone with them for all those 210 years. It wasn't 210. They were there for 210 years, but... What? Yeah. So, there was someone with them for all of those years who was noting everything. None of their suffering went ignored. All of the suffering was being very closely noted. He was right there with them. and now he's there, flashing, giving these flashes. There was this element, there was that element, it's all being thrown back into Mitzrayim's faces. Okay. What's that? Of actual bondage? 80. Okay. Now, they were there, they were in Mitzrayim altogether for 200. 1 minute. It was 80 years of bondage or 80 years before the bondage? I don't remember the cheshbon.
80 years of heavy
bondage. Of heavy bondage. Oh, okay. Now, finally the Makom finishes. What does Mitzrayim look like? So this is not long after Dam, but now this is compounded with masses of dead frogs stinking and rotting in the streets. This is basically what they walked through after. Sure, the Makom was finished, but this is what they were wading through. They were all still there, they just weren't moving. That was the big revach, and that was very significant. But they're still wading through half rotten, rotting dead frogs. This certainly contributed to the general ecological effects of what the state of the land at that time. Okay, now we move on to the next midah. And once again, Pari's back at the negotiating table. What happens here? Let's know what's going on. He's alalti b'mitzrayim. Hashem is simply making a joke out of Pari. Pari doesn't even see it. What happens? Hashem comes again. This is the God of the Mitzrayim. The God of the Hebrews. Pari had challenged him. Round one, Pari was knocked flat. Round two, Pari is knocked flat. Hashem could have left him on the floor and told the Jewish people, "Hey, come, walk over him. We're on our way out." Now, what does Hashem do? Hashem reaches down, lifts him back up by the back of his neck, plunks him back down at the negotiating table, and says, "Okay, Pari, so you're gonna let them go? It's up to you." Oh, Pari's back at the negotiating. He's a little dizzy, but he's back at the negotiating table. No, he's still the boss. This God of the Hebrews still needs his consent. Okay, fine. Round three, Makaskim. So here also, let's note a few things. Yes, but I don't know. Meaning the Mephoshim do talk about that, but I'm not factoring that in now. Makaskim. So here, Kinim is a very important part. We're going to start with the Midah Keneged Midah this time. We know from the experience of our own grandparents, parents, great-grandparents, here's where we really bring home the concept of dehumanization. The Nazis knew what they were doing. It wasn't just to kill, it wasn't just to persecute, it wasn't just to be rid, but they made a project of humiliating them to the worst extent, of mamish stripping them of any semblance of human beings. And they had measured methods of doing it. It was a science. Now this also helped in being able to do what they were doing without being bothered by whatever conscience they had. Once you manage to create the impression that these people are not like you, it's a whole different thing. These are things. Dirty, disgusting, bug-like people. It's much easier to just step on them. Wow, you are, right? Nazi is in a iron, polished uniform, clean-shaven, perfumed, right?